listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today is Monday, February 8th. I got some positive feedback last week about the Sun Report, so I'm sticking with that until the spring has sprung. Today in Burlington, the sun rose at 7.03 a.m. and is due to set at 5.10 p.m. That's 19 more minutes of daylight than we had last Monday. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Janet Reed, an agent with Fine Print Literary Management in New York. She specializes in compelling fiction, particularly crime fiction and narrative nonfiction. Her publishing background includes 15 years in book publicity with clients, both famous and infamous. She looks for projects that show mastery of craft and originality. Some of her recent sales include Even by Andrew Grant, The Breach by Patrick Lee, Chasing Smoke by Bill Cameron, Brains by Robin Becker, The Little Book of Curses and Maledictions for Everyday Use by Dawn Ray Downton. Janet Reed is a member of the Literary Agents Professional Association, AAR, as well as a past board member of the New York City chapter of the Women's National Book Association. She's an associate member of Mystery Writers of America and International Thriller Writers. Janet keeps a blog, answering questions about publishing and query letters and other things that strike her interest at jetreedliterary.blogspot.com. That's Jet as in the airplane, and Reed is spelled R-E-I-D. Her second blog, Query Shark, specializes in the sometimes ruthless critique of query letters submitted by blog readers. In her spare hours, according to her bio, she drinks scotch and stalks Jack Reacher. When I spoke to Janet a couple weeks ago, I asked her if she thinks literary agents tend to have any particular characteristics in common.
It's funny that you should ask that right after I was looking at a blog that's being kept by the Writers' Conference that several of us are going to in April of this year, 2010. And they're interviewing all the agents who are going, and one of the questions they ask is, what period of time would you like to live in? And three of us, one after another, all said the future.
Oh, wow.
And I thought that... I was the first one who answered that. I thought, oh, I'm so brilliant and so smart. And then everybody else, and these interviews were done before, nobody had seen my answer before. I mean, they weren't all copying me, is what I'm trying to say, even though my post is first.
Right.
But I thought that it was indicative of the fact that I think agents share optimism. I think we have to. We are, you know, the glass is half full kind of people. We're always looking in the query pile for the next big thing, and the thing is, I think we all know that it's coming. So I think optimism and a shared sense of excitement about what's coming up, the future, is probably the one thing that binds every agent, be they representing fiction, nonfiction, you know, commercial interests, academic interests, is that sense of optimism about the future.
And I would think they have to be really optimistic in the industry right now, with the future being sort of unknown.
The future is always unknown.
Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah, and there's, you know, one thing that will never change is that although we are optimists, we do like to complain, and we do like to prognosticate, and we do like to wring our hands and talk about the good old days. Well, most of us who are wringing our hands about the good old days weren't alive in the good old days. You know, it's always, you know, yesterday is always better than what's up ahead. Yes, of course, the industry is changing, but it's changing in exciting new ways.
Yeah.
There will always be a need for people who tell stories, and there will always be a need for people to help those authors manage their intellectual property, and that's my job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my guys may be published, you know, electronically, they may be published on flashing billboards, they may be published on telephones, who knows? But they're always going to need somebody who can read the damn royalty stamp. They don't want to do it. I mean, every single client I represent, you know, they're not saying, oh, agents are going by the wayside. They're saying, please, help me more.
Tell me this.
Yeah, they don't want to learn the business side of things. They want to write. And, you know, God love them, that's exactly what they should be doing because they're brilliant and talented at writing. They don't need an accounting degree. Well, like, nobody needs an accounting degree. I'm not sure what you need, a magician's degree read royalty statements. So,
well, let's talk about your work specifically. What types of books do you like to represent?
Well, primarily my list right now is focused on crime fiction, down-market commercial thrillers. I've got Patrick Leahy's The Breach, which is sitting on the New York Times bestseller list last week in this, which has been a lot of fun.
Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you. I had nothing to do with it. I just sat around and said, hey, that's a good book. And the sales force at Harper said, hey, that's a good book. And 50,000 people bought it and said, hey, that's a good book. I said, yeah, I just saw it first. And I've got Crashers by Dana Haynes coming out this May, sort of May/June.
Okay.
Which is going to be a wonderful story about an airplane and the NTSB crash investigators, who normally have as much time as they need to investigate a crash. This time they have a week, only they don't know it before the terrorist brings down the next plane.
Oh.
It's absolutely a riveting thriller. I'm not sure how much space we're going to get in airport bookstores, but it's a wonderful story. So those are the kinds of things I'm focused on. I love reading those. And I'm always on the lookout for those. But I'm also looking for what I would say are quieter books, but nonetheless terrifying. And we're calling it bad mother lit in the office.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is a category that we invented. It's certainly not a category that if you asked an editor if she was looking for, she would say yes. But I've got several books on my list right now that I'm shopping. One of which involves a mother who has twins and takes her son into the park one day and leaves him and walks away.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the story of what happens afterwards. The boy is found the next day. He's unhurt. The mother comes back 3 days later in a complete fog. She can't explain what she did or why she did it or anything that happened in the 3 days that she was gone. It's not a supernatural mystery. This is real life.
This is a memoir?
No, it's fiction. But it's real. Yeah, I would think of it in the Chris Bojalian vein of exploring family issues. The boy that she leaves in the park is autistic.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and the woman who wrote the book, her name is Deb Block. She is also the parent of an autistic child. So I want to be very clear that it's not a memoir. She did not leave her child in the woods. But this is an exploration of what happens to a family after somebody commits a terrible, terrible act of neglect. How do you forgive? How do you get past it? I mean, what are you going to do? You can't say you can't come home. How does the family live? How does this child live with his mom? So it's an exploration of the unforgivable within a family. And I got to tell you, there are people in the office who, I mean, we got into fist fights about this book. People were so outraged about it. The very concept of it challenges the idea of what is a good mother? What would a mother do? We always think of mothers as being, you know, the primary defenders of their children, the mother bear, that kind of thing. And here's a woman who walked away from her kids in the forest.
Right.
Anyway, so those are the kinds of things, you know, challenging, compelling books. It doesn't hurt that Deb Block is an extraordinary writer. The book, her voice is utterly compelling, and she can, oh my God, that woman can write. So those are the other kinds of things that I'm looking for. Always voice and always some sort of very compelling hook or concept to the book. That's always what I'm looking for.
Okay. All right. Great. How do you look for clients?
Well, that's easy. People send me query letters. They send them to me by the hundreds, and I read every single one of them, and I'm very pleased that I find probably 70% of my clients in what we lovingly call the slush pile, which is actually just people finding my name, looking up the kinds of things I like to read, and sending me their work. I'm very glad to hear from people. I also hear from editors who have gotten things at conferences and like them and know they want to work with an agent, so they direct the writer to usually one or more agents and say, you know, please tell them that I sent you. Friends of clients, friends of family, those kinds of things, those kinds of referrals are often, well, not often, but probably 30% of the list, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are agent shopping, you know, who have had one agent and parted ways and then come looking. Those, you know, I meet those at like VoucherCon and Left Coast Crime, people who are shopping for agents. But I would say a good 70% of my people are people I never met before who just wrote me a letter and said, here's my book. And I said, send more, send more, send more.
Oh, that's great to hear. 70%. That's wonderful to hear.
Easily. Yeah. And most agents I know work exactly the same way. There's a lot of talk about how slush piles don't work and how blind, you know, just over the transom queries don't work, but that is absolutely not true. It works all the time.
Well, that's great to hear. Now, you mentioned a minute that sometimes people are shopping for agents. They've had a relationship with an agent that didn't work out, perhaps. So how should they bring that information to the next agent that they're querying?
Well, as you might suspect, with somebody as agent shopping, the questions that I ask are a lot different. If somebody's just coming in through the transom, I want to make sure they're informed about, you know, how to look for an agent, the kinds of things, the kind of questions they want to ask.
Right.
If somebody's already had representation, hopefully they've asked those questions before. So the one thing that I want to know is what didn't work in that previous relationship, because if the reason that they parted from their old agent is something that I think is exactly what they're going to find with me, you know, it's better to save everybody the trouble and just say, you know, I think you need a different style of agent. I'm not the right girl.
Right.
But I think you have to know what kind of agent you want. And sometimes the way that you find that out is by having the agent that you don't want.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be very clear. You have to be very clear about what you're looking for and what's realistic. I have had some people who have been had very unrealistic expectations about either how much time they would get or how much time it would take to respond to them. And a friend of mine says there are no emergencies in publishing, and it's pretty much true. There's almost nothing that happens in publishing where the decision needs to be made instantly.
Okay.
And so people who say, well, I need to know by 5 p.m. today, well, okay, that's easy. No. figuring out, you know, realistic expectations and figuring out what you want, those are the two keys for agent changing. I don't advise people to change agents readily. It's not a good sign. If somebody comes to me and they've had 3 agents before, they have a much higher threshold even to talk to me. I don't want to talk to somebody who's obviously been through that many agents. That
right.
said, there are a lot of agents who are agents in name only. And when somebody has to leave because they figured that out, it's tough. I mean, if you've made 2 bad decisions, it's like marriage, you know?
Right.
Who wants to marry somebody who's been married 5 times? But I always ask who the agent was, too.
And that'll help, because you'll know who
and
that person
is. You know, I have pretty good radar about who's, you know, who's real and who's not and who's working and who's not. And so if they come up with 3 agents that I've never heard of who, you know, practice in Fargo, North Dakota, well, that's a different set of experiences than, for example, if they said their last agent was Barbara Powell, they don't even get to keep talking to me. Because Barbara's a fabulous agent. She's my competitor. She doesn't work at my agency. I have enormous respect for her. If a client leaves her, we're done.
Right, right. Okay.
Well, they're an idiot. I don't work with idiots. It's kind of like a rule.
Well, what if they left someone who you respected, a competitor who you respected, who just wasn't able to sell their book in a certain period of time, they finally decided they want somebody else to give it a fresh shot.
And I have 2 people on my list who fit that exact description. And that's okay, because, you know, there are those situations. But I like to be very clear about what they're looking for, and I want them to be very clear about what they're getting. But, yeah, that works.
Yeah.
I make sure that they have parted ways from the previous agent for more than 5 minutes, too. It's not... I won't talk to a client of an agent if they're currently represented. There's an absolutely strict line. If you have an agent right now, you can't talk to me.
Yeah.
Not even informally. There's no poaching allowed, and our agency is very strict about that.
Okay.
But if they have parted ways and they know that they're looking for somebody else, I'm happy to sit down and we talk about what they're looking for, and it works. Dana Cameron, who was just nominated for an Edgar for her short story, Femme Soul, which is in the anthology Boston Noir had an agent before she had me. And she was very methodical. She knew exactly what she wanted. She interviewed several agents, and I was very pleased to be selected. And I think she did a good job.
Yeah.
Her previous agent was an excellent agent. Dana was just going to go in a different direction. And sometimes that requires a different agent. And I've had people leave me because they needed to take a different direction. The parting has been amicable. I always support their work. I'm glad to buy their books. I just wasn't the right person for that particular body of work. And
yeah.
That stuff happens. It's
right.
You know, you just have to be careful about when and how you do it.
Right. So you know who the agents are out there. You sort of know how they work. But what about a writer who is new to trying to get published? How do they find the best agent for themselves, you know, and make a good
yeah.
fit?
Well, there are two steps to that. The first one is to avoid the people who are out there to scam you. Those agents are the ones that you first see because they're the ones who run Google ads. They're the ones who run ads in the back of Writer's Digest. They're the ones who say things like, I'll get you published.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a reader's fee or I have a retainer fee. You know, anything that involves an author sending an agent money, those are the first people you want to avoid.
Okay.
And a lot of people don't realize that, but agents are only paid after they've made the sale. So anybody who wants money ahead of time, run like the wind. That's the first level, avoiding the scammers.
Yep.
Second level is finding somebody who's actually a real working agent, as opposed to somebody who has hung out their shingle and said, I'm going to be an agent because I really love writers and I really want to help them. Ineffective agents. And there are a couple of things you look for there. One, the first question you always ask any agent ever is, what have you sold?
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer is nothing, you want to be very, very careful. Now, there are agents who, you know, start out. I mean, when I started out, I hadn't sold anything either. But those, if you're going to sign with somebody like that, you want to make sure they're working in an agency that has been in existence for a long time, and that they have, you know, help and support from established agents. You don't want to sign with somebody who's never sold anything and is working by themselves someplace else. This business is a business of connections, and you can't make those connections fast enough to actually sell something if you're just starting out.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an entry-level job.
Right. It's not just about passion. It's about who you know.
This is a business. It is
yeah.
about who you know. And almost more important than who you know, it's knowing how this industry works. Because my job, I mean, a lot of authors focus on, can you sell my work? Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't want to make light of this, but yeah, any fool can sell a book. Truly, anybody can sell a book. If you have a great book, publishers will buy it.
Mm-hmm.
But the real value of an agent is after the sale, saving the sale, making sure that you're with the right editor. When your editor leaves the house and you're dumped with somebody else, you know, maybe making a shift in editor, an agent is your advocate, and you want somebody who knows the business and knows everybody at the publisher and can help you, and somebody who is outside of the publishing industry just doesn't have that knowledge. They have good intentions, they have passion, but you absolutely have to know enough to advocate for your clients. And that is harder for authors to figure out. But there are resources now that there weren't 10 years ago, and one of the best ones is a website called absoluteright.com.
Mm-hmm.
And on that website, which is a huge website, and it's thousands and thousands of people sharing information about agents who worked, agents who didn't. It's very author-centric, so some of the opinions there are probably not opinions I share. But it's a good place for a writer who is, you know, testing the waters to get some pretty good advice about who to avoid and who not to. And it just gives you information. You know, yes, it takes 3 months for some agents to reply to query letters. You know, a form rejection is not an insult to your work. That kind of information that's just not available until you actually start investigating how publishing works. It's a wonderful resource.
Okay.
And I direct almost everybody who's starting out in publishing to that website.
Oh, that's great. That's good information. Because there are a number of websites out there that are aimed at writers who are trying to do this research.
Query Tracker is also a very good one. But that's mostly just blocks of information about agents, as far as I know. Absolute Right has a bulletin board where authors talk to each other, and it's that exchange of information, I think, that sets it above everybody else. But there are several very good sources of information about agents and how to contact them.
Okay, great. Let's talk about your work day. What do you do in a typical day?
There is no typical day. Tuesday morning, I was roused from my bed I was at home and the phone rang, and I stumbled to the phone and I missed the call and I thought, ah, crap. So I turned on my computer and I was reading my mail, and by God, there was an announcement from Mystery Writers of America that Sophie Littlefield had been nominated for Best First Novel. Well, I don't represent Sophie, but Barbara Powell does.
Uh-huh.
Who's my friend. And I know and love Sophie. So, of course, I called Barbara and we screamed and yelled for an hour. And then I continued to read. And then I read the rest of the list and it was like, oh, one of my clients is on there too. So that, of course, my client had been the one who'd called me. So I called her back and said, oh! So we screamed and yelled for an hour. And then, you know, there was an hour trying to figure out floral shops in California and Massachusetts and get these girls flowers and then get the news up on the website. I mean, that's a complete anomaly, but that was Tuesday. And then the week before, Patrick Lee hits the bestseller list, and that takes all that time. But normally, I mean, if nothing crazy happens, which is very unusual, I get up, read my email, make sure that nothing has caught on fire overnight. I go into the office, and I pull out my call sheets, which are lists of editors that I call about projects that are on submission or in various acquisition levels. And I talk to editors pretty much all day. And my clients call me or email me, and we talk about cover art. We talk about foreign rights. We talk about all that kind of stuff. And then at the end of the day, I open my mail and I read my query letters and do all the sort of the business-like things.
Yeah, right.
But mostly I spend my day talking to people about projects, and I love that. It's the most fun ever.
Yeah.
I love talking about my clients' books. I mean, think about how fun it is to talk about books you love. I get paid to do that every day. What's not to love about this job? But we also, you know, we're doing 1099s for our clients in January. So there's an element of that pretty much right now. A lot of that happens at night. There's all sorts of stuff that goes on with managing careers, but mostly it's just making connections, talking to editors, and talking to clients about work, and it's fun. And then there's talking on the radio periodically, which is always fun.
and there's managing your blogs, which I would think is almost a full-time job in itself. How do you
find
the time?
No. I mean, I wish, you know, it would be lovely, because that would mean that somehow I'd figured out a way to get paid for it. the blog, I keep two, of course. There's the jetreadliterary.blogspot.com, which is me ranting about publishing. And that, you know, I use that to talk about my clients a lot, which is a lot of fun. But, it's 20, 30 minutes a day. You'll notice probably most of those posts are made late at night. You know, you come home after a day of talking to people, and the last thing you want to do is talk. So you're right. And then Query Shark, you know, is a very sporadic blog that I keep critiquing query letters. And I usually get shamed into posting a little more often. Somebody will say, where have you been? It's like, oh, crud, I haven't posted to that in a month.
I can't believe anybody could complain about Query Shark. It's such an amazing resource. I just was so excited when I found Query Shark.
I'll tell you, it dawned on me at one point after a writing conference. I can tell you specifically when it was. We were doing a workshop here in New York called Query Roulette, where we were trying to help people with their query letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that when they got feedback and could give me the revisions, they got better, significantly better, within about three rounds. And I thought, why aren't we doing this? And, of course, the reason is time and money.
Right.
So I started Query Shark, and I have been very, very heartened to see that there are several people who have gotten pretty decent query letters from, you know, total crap that they sent in. And I, in fact, signed one of the guys who sent in a query that I loved. It didn't need much revision. But I found him out of the query shark slush pile, and that's not a normal thing. But the thing is that, you know, it's you're writing in isolation, you know, sitting at your home, you know, you're reading these websites about how to do it. But until somebody actually says this, that, and that, do it again, it's like doing math problems.
Right.
It's really hard to do them without feedback. So I have now started at all writing conferences. I beg them to let me teach queries so that I can actually have people go through the revision process there. And I'm getting ready to do that this weekend, in fact. And
where are you going this weekend?
I'll be in Greater Lehigh, at the Greater Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania Writing Group, which is in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And there are about 35 people who will come, and we do fundamentals of queries in the morning. So, you know, here's what it's supposed to look like. We break for lunch. They come back with their query letter. They've sent me their query letters, actually, ahead of time. I've marked them up, and we go through fundamentals. I give them back their queries. They rewrite them, and we critique them right there in front of everybody. It's not so much, well, okay, it's brutal.
but do you find most writers can handle brutal?
I tell you, my respect for writers as a group, individually and collectively, is enormous, because they not only let me do it, they ask me to do it, and they say, please, and they want to do it. They want to get better. Writers are desperate for feedback. They want this so much that they're willing to have somebody say, you know, in public, you know, this stinks, don't do this, do that.
Right.
I can't think of it. Well, most artists are like that, but it's incredible. It's just incredible.
Now, apart from the really obvious things like typos and poor grammar, what can you tell from a writer in a single page query letter? I mean, this is always a mystery to me. How much can you tell from someone who's writing one page?
Well, you can tell if they're a good writer.
You can.
It's true. If you are a good writer, you can write a good query letter. And if you're not a good writer, you can't. A one-page query letter is an art form, but people who use language well use it well in a one-page query letter just like they use it in a novel.
Yeah. Okay.
The art form of getting your point across is a little different. So even though people make, you know, I have signed and sold people who did not send me traditionally the correct query, but the voice and the writing was so good that I thought, I know this is going to be a good novel, and of course I've read it and you know, signed it and sold it. But good writing shows through in one page. And if you were reading my incoming queries, if anybody read my incoming queries for a week, they would begin to see it as well. And I know that's true because we have interns who read the incoming queries that come to the agency. Several of our more senior agents get hundreds of query letters a week. And so the interns sort the ones that are clearly not correct and send those back. But they start reading with absolutely fresh eyes. They've never seen they haven't seen a query letter before. They've seen a couple. But they're not jaded.
Right.
And within a week, they have gotten so much better at saying, okay, we know this one doesn't work. And it's just experience. I've been doing this for a long time. And I can tell within a page. That said, I do ask for people to send me first 3 to 5 pages of their novel, so that just in case, if the premise is interesting, the concept is good, and the writing is, you know, not horrible, you know, I can look at the novel and, you know, get a sense of how the writing is.
Right.
But yeah, I can tell, absolutely. And you could too if you were doing my job. It's not brain surgery.
Okay. A minute ago, you mentioned your agency, the fact that you use interns perhaps to field some of the initial queries.
Well, for some of the other agents, I read all my own queries myself.
Oh, okay. I'm curious, is there a certain etiquette to approaching multiple agents in the same agency with a single project, or is that just totally fine? Everybody should
No. You want to do it one at a time.
One at a time.
Yeah, absolutely. In that, if I really like a project, the first step I usually take is having somebody else in my agency read it, just to get, you know, maybe I've missed something, or maybe they know about a book that's the exact kind of book and has been picked up someplace else. It's called getting second reads. And I got to tell you, if somebody looked at me and said, oh, I'm reading this query too, you know, there would be blood on the floor as we tried to figure out, you know, who got the project. The writer just didn't know what he or she was supposed to do. And it does happen.
Yeah.
But what can't happen is if my boss says no to a project, I'm not going to pick it up. I mean, she's got really good taste and she's really smart. So, you know, anything she says no to, it's pretty much not going to be something I'm going to sign.
Uh-huh.
So it's better to go one at a time, absolutely.
Okay, all right. Here's another etiquette question. Should writers ever assume that an agent wants an exclusive read, or will the agent always specifically say, I want to have an exclusive read?
Well, I think that exclusives stink. I think that they're bad business on the part of the agent. I think that they're not in an author's best interest. So I strongly, in the strongest possible terms, urge authors to not only not assume exclusives, but to not offer them, and if they're asked for, to put very strict time limits on them. Exclusives are not in an author's best interest because you want as many agents who want this project as possible to be talking to you about how they're the best agent. You don't make a choice about an agent based on just one person saying, I want you.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the right person offers the first time, and that's great. But an exclusive assumes that you're not going to send this to anybody else, and if this agent offers, you're going to accept. And that's crazy talk. So I always encourage people to not assume exclusives, and if they're asked for, to be very, very, very rigid about it's a 1 week, it's 10 days, it's 2 weeks, and that's it. And not to agree to them if at all possible. And most agents are just, you know, they're just trying to get their paws on something. And so they say, no, Janet Reed is reading it too. It's just going to have to be in the scrum. And if they say no, you understand something about how that agency works. I mean, I got to tell you, I want an agent who's willing to fight for my stuff, who's willing to be competitive, who enjoys being able to pitch her own agency as, you know, well as she could pitch my book. I mean, why would you sign with somebody who doesn't expect to be competitive? You know,
mm-hmm.
I that's why I think it's bad business for agents to ask for exclusives. I think it demonstrates laziness.
I want to just mention, and we don't have to actually talk in detail about it because it's a whole chart, but you have this great chart on your blog about what one needs before they query.
Ah, yes.
And it's just a great chart. So I just want to mention, and I think that was on your Janet Reed.
It is. It's on jetreadliterary.blogspot.com, exactly.
Yeah, I won't even go into that. I was going to ask you about it, but I think that probably I'll just direct people to go look at it. What's the best way for authors to get in touch with you? Do you have certain preferences about snail mail, email? All that.
Email is probably the best in that it's fast. Two, it allows me to keep track of, you know, where your query is. If somebody says, I queried you and you didn't respond, I can check and see what happened. So querying electronically is definitely preferred. And it's, you know, they just send a query to my regular email address, janet@fineprintlit.com. And they put in a, you know, they just write a query letter, and then in the body of the email, they include the first three pages of the novel or the memoir, and I'm happy to read it. I'm glad to read it. I usually read pretty fast, and I think my blog says I'm caught up through January 6th, but I'm really caught up through about January 14th, and today's what we're taking.
21st.
21st. You know, I run about a week to 10 days. Now, that slows down a little bit sometimes, but you know, I'm pretty fast.
And
I do like people to query me electronically. Paper, we still take paper. You know, you can send it on the back of a $20 bill if you want, but but electronic is definitely faster, and it allows authors to keep track, I think, more easily of where a query has been and what somebody has said.
Okay. Now, in the query, do you want to know right about the story right up front, or do you first want to know that this is your mother's best friend from, you know, Nebraska? What's the best way for someone to start?
My preference, and I just really, really think this is the right way to go, is you want to lead with the strongest persuader, and that is this book that you're writing to me about is an incredible read. Start with the book, you know, and you start with the name of the character. Travis Chase is faced with a dilemma. I mean, you want to start with the character and what problem that he had, so that I'm pulled into your story right away. It's the most compelling, most gripping thing. The fact that you found me on a blog, the fact that you're my mother's best friend, all of that is secondary to whether or not this book is something that I want to read. So when I teach query classes, I always advise people to start with the name of their character and what the problem is that they face, what choices they have to make.
Okay.
Particularly if you're querying electronically, you have fewer available lines for an eyeball to look at. And some agents now are reading their queries on their BlackBerries. They're reading them on their iPhones.
Great.
I mean, you've got 10 lines. Why waste it? I mean, the people who waste it on their return address and my address just make me crazy. You know, don't waste on anything other than the story. Start with the story.
Okay. All right. You often read that writers should get introductions to agents maybe from their clients. What about writers that don't have any contacts? Should they get in touch with the agent's clients and say, hi, how do you do? I'm a stranger. Can you introduce me to your agent?
No.
No.
That's called stalking, and that's not a good thing. 70% of my clients came to me with no introduction, no knowledge, no connection, nothing. They wrote me an email, and I read it, and I loved it. You don't need an introduction. You don't need a referral. You don't need to know someone. You can send a query to any agent anywhere without knowing anything, and they will read your query. Now, some of the more established agencies make it very, very hard to do that because they're not really looking for new clients. But most agents are looking for good clients, and they're looking for good projects. They want to hear from you. So don't waste a single minute thinking that you need some sort of connection.
Okay.
That said, it's always valuable if I've actually met you, and particularly if you're at the very raw stage of querying, sometimes the query letter just is so terrible that you can't even see straight. But if I've met you at a conference and had a chance to talk to you a little bit, sometimes I can say, well, now that sounds interesting, you know, send me some chapters and we'll see what you can do. So conferences are valuable, but you absolutely can query somebody totally cold and get your book read, get your query letter read at least.
Okay. All right. Now, do you ever ask for edits from prospective clients before you'll sign them? You do.
All the time. All the time. Absolutely. Two reasons. One, a set of fresh eyes on a book usually, at the very least, there are typos that need to be fixed.
Right.
And sometimes, for example, Deb Locke, the author of the book about the family that's going into the woods, essentially.
Yes.
The book is called Lost and Found. She did three major edits for me. We tightened that book up very, very considerably. And that was before I signed her. I've got three potential clients who are working on some revisions right now. Who are not signed with me, but I've asked them to make revisions and worked with them very closely on what those revisions should look like. Then there are two reasons. One, I want the best possible book to send out. And the other part of that is I want to see how they are about revisions, because I'm not going to sign somebody who says, I'm sorry, but every word that I put down here is, you know, perfect, and I'm not going to edit, because an editor is going to edit.
Right.
And you need to know ahead of time if you're sending in a client who is obstreperous about editing. I won't do that. I like my editor friends, and I'm not going to make their lives any more miserable than I'm absolutely required to. And so I like to send them people who have experience with the editorial process and know that it won't kill them.
How many times might you read the same manuscript and continue to ask for edits before you either say, look, I've seen it too many times, or I'm ready to sign?
Well, it varies. I probably, at some point, you are committed to the project. And you might as well just say, okay, you know, we're signing here. If we get to a point where the client's vision or the potential client's vision is different than mine, or they're just not getting there, that doesn't happen very often. Almost everybody that I've worked with that extensively has signed with me. On the other hand, I do know people who have worked extensively with authors, gotten the manuscript into what we would consider ready to go out on submission, and the author turned around and queried with that new manuscript and signed with somebody else.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, it's not, they aren't represented, so there's no real breach of ethics. There's certainly nothing illegal about it. But it didn't set so well with me when
yeah.
I heard about that happening.
Well, once you've invested a certain amount of time with a certain person, even if you don't have a contract.
But the obligation, an author does not have an obligation to sign with an agent if they don't think the agent's going to represent them to the best. I mean, if they find a better agent. An author really has to look out for themselves. But it was a very difficult. Those kinds of things are very difficult, and I've not faced that myself, and I'm glad because I'm not sure how I'd feel about it. Bad, best way to describe that. But it has happened, but not the people that I've got working right now in revisions are I think pretty much all ready to sign when we agree that we've got something that can be sent out.
Okay. Once you do sign a client, what are your expectations of that person? What will you expect from them in working together?
That they will write brilliant novels for the rest of their lives.
Lots and lots of them.
Well, I pretty much expect them to behave exactly like they did before, you know, we went out on submissions. In that it's kind of funny. Authors, not, I don't want to say stalk, they can research agents for a long time and make lists of the ones that they think are good and watch their blogs and read their blogs and get to know them. We, on the other side of that relationship, on the other hand, we get a query letter, we read the pages, we fall in love with the book, and then we meet the author, and sometimes it's almost like, you know, a mail order bride. We don't know exactly what we're getting. And so, you know, I do like to have a couple of conversations with people. And, you know, we usually by this point have had, you know, some extended email conversations. And I have a phone conversation. But I've signed people that I've never met. And I, you know, it's always hoping that they don't turn out to be crazy. They never have. Which has been my good fortune.
Never? But, really?
Nope. Well, I mean, not crazy in a bad way. All my authors are crazy in a very good way, in that they are very bright, very creative people, and they're very funny. Mm-hmm. So they're, you know, they're crazy, really good crazy, hilariously crazy. I love them. But that said, like in any mail order bride marriage, I ask that my clients, if they have a problem or if they're not happy, that they tell me about it, rather than either fester in silence or just assume that I don't love them anymore, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So my expectation is that they talk to me. I keep a private blog that only my authors can see, keeping them posted on industry news, changes at fine print, personnel issues that they need to know about, you know, when 1099s have gone out, that kind of sort of stuff that all of my clients need to know.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, I do a lot of sort of broadcasting, you know, here's the news, but I expect them to email me back or to talk to me about specific things that they're having, so that specific problems that they're having, so that we can deal with it. The last thing that I want is an unhappy client. It's easy to forget clients. I mean, they've written the book. I'm out there shopping it. I'm talking about them every day.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm in constant contact with them. And then I get these forlorn little emails. I haven't heard from you in a month. And it's like, really? Because I've been talking about you for a month. I feel like I'm a little tired of you right now. It's like, really? Yeah. Oh, right. Maybe I should tell you that I've been talking about you every day. So, there is a little bit of a disconnect there, in that the most important person, you know, in my life are my clients, because they're writing the books that I'm selling, or actually sometimes the people that I'm talking to least, which is one of the benefits of Twitter, which
yeah.
is a wonderful way to sort of keep very lightly in touch with my clients. And we have little Twitter conversations.
Yeah, well, actually, that's really funny that you said that, because that was my next question. I want to talk a little bit about social networking. And how necessary you feel that it is for writers.
Well, I'm necessary is, makes it sound like you absolutely have to do it. Some people are very uncomfortable with it, and that's fine. That's, you know, you should not be doing something that you just loathe, because that loathing will come through and it becomes ineffective social networking. If you don't want to be at a party, you're the last person who should go, because you're a big old rain cloud. That said, I think that social networking is a very powerful tool for a writer who wants to take advantage of it. Facebook, you can connect with lots and lots of people very easily and let them know about your book that's coming out. Twitter is the same kind of thing. For me, Twitter is a very powerful tool for staying in touch both with my clients and sometimes with editors. There are a lot of editors who are on Twitter. It's not so much that we talk to each other, it's just I see what they're thinking about. And I have had, I've copy edited books using the expertise available to me on Twitter.
Hmm.
For example, I'm not familiar with Los Angeles as much as familiar with Los Angeles as, for example, somebody who actually like lives there.
Right.
So I had a question about Los Angeles. So I put it up on a Twitter form, you know, can anybody tell me, are there brownstones in Los Angeles? And I had 25 replies. Are you crazy? Of course not. So I was able to find out information that was not readily available to me through any other source just by asking people who live in Los Angeles, which is great. My clients have actually become friends with each other through Twitter, which is a very strange phenomenon. but again, they become each other's both support group, cheering section, and beta readers in many cases. They're all reading each other's books. God knows what they're saying about their agent.
Hopefully I was going to say, Janet, they're talking about you.
I'm sure they are. You know, I just have to trust that I'm doing a good enough job that mostly what they're saying is good stuff. I know that they've got some complaints, because in any relationship, somebody's always got complaints, and that's okay. But at least they know everybody's got the same complaint. Or they can brainstorm about how to get me to, you know, do something else. But they're all such smart, brilliant people that it's kind of fun to help them find each other, because they're all word nerds. They're all working at home, hunched over a typewriter or a computer screen. You know, writing is an isolated art form, and if they can meet and connect with other writers and share their pain, that's so much the better.
Yeah.
Plus, they all write really great books that everybody should read.
Yeah, yeah. You know, a minute ago you mentioned something about how all of your clients are crazy in a good way, and it reminded me that you had a link on your blog to one of your authors. I'm sorry I didn't write down her name, but her book has something to do with the brain. What was it?
Oh, that's Robin Becker.
Oh, that was so funny. She got the galleys for her book?
She got the galleys for her book, which is called Brains, which is a zombie memoir.
That's it. Okay.
Yeah. And she, I'd never seen anybody do this before, but she took photos of the galley, calling it galley, of different things, you know, dressed it up in doll clothes, took it on a canoe ride. It was the funniest thing I'd ever seen.
It was so, funny.
It was. And so we took pictures of galleys, you know, sister who lives in New York, because I get copies of the galleys too, and posted. Robin Becker is, I got to tell you, one of the, she's hilarious. And the book is hilarious too. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's an example of social networking working, because I've never met her. I didn't know about her until I saw this. And I'm like, I'm going to buy this book. It looks so funny.
Yeah,
so.
And it's on her blog. She keeps a blog called Zombies and Cream, and that post was on her blog, and I saw it, and it went from there. Yeah, social networking can be effective, very, very effective for meeting people who would not ordinarily know you.
Yeah.
It extends your reach.
Now, I do have one really tiny question about your blog. Do you hate dependent clauses in all writing or just in query letters?
Well, I it's not so much that I hate dependent clauses as that I hate dependent clauses that are not well used.
Okay.
You can do anything you want if you do it with elegance and charm.
Okay.
But you have to do it really, really well.
Okay.
It's like Mikhail Baryshnikov. He can fall down and when he's dancing. And if he makes it look like he planned to do it and it's funny, it works. But if you just tip over off of your ballet shoes, it's not quite as wonderful. So you have to be in control of your writing, and then you can do anything you want. You can write it in the damn second person if you want, but you have to do
Jay
it
McInerney
really,
did.
Really well.
Right. All right. I'm coming to the end of my questions. Just a couple more. First, I'm wondering if there are any books that you might recommend that would help writers either with revision or understanding the business or approaching agents. Are there certain special books that you particularly like?
Pat Walsh's, I'm probably going to get the number wrong, but it's Pat Walsh's, W-A-L-S-H. He's an editor at McAdam Cage, and his book is 76 Reasons That You Won't Get Published.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And it's probably one of the best books I've ever read. Just in general, about the writing life and creativity and building the habit of excellence, nothing beats Twyla Tharp's book, The Creative Habit, nothing. And, of course, Stephen King's book on writing. I think one of the best books you can read on writing.
It's such an interesting book, too, because it's a book on writing, and it's a memoir, and it sort of changes halfway through, and it's really interesting every page, I think.
Yeah, I've never read a Stephen King novel, ever, but I've read that book. Oh. Yeah, and he's so amazing. I just can't get over how amazing he is. So we actually bought a copy of Under the Dome, his new one, for the office.
Okay.
So that all of us could read it. It's like 4 million pages.
Do you have time to read books?
Oh, absolutely. You have to read books. One, for two reasons. One, you really have to stay abreast of what people are doing. But the other part of that is that you have to retune your eyeballs periodically. When you are reading a lot of incoming queries, sometimes you lose your it's like you have to sharpen your knife.
Mm-hmm.
When you've been chopping things a long time, you get a little dull. So you have to read something that you know is amazing and recalibrate. And so I do that.
Okay.
And then sometimes you just want to go someplace else. I mean, you have a bad week and you just want to go someplace else in a completely different vein, and you don't want to have your inner agent eye connected. Do I like this? Does this work? It's just read it for fun. So yeah, I do a lot of what I would call pleasure reading. I love to read.
I just think it's amazing that you have time. I mean, with all of the, not even query letters, but all the manuscripts you must have to read.
Well, I don't actually have a life, so it makes it a lot easier.
Okay.
I don't have children. I don't cook. I don't clean. I don't, I don't have pets. People who have lives, they have a lot less time than I do. I work. But the good thing about that is I love what I do.
Yeah.
I love what I do. I am so fortunate to have landed in a job in an industry that I love. I mean, I know that there are so many people who do not love what they do, and I feel blessed every single day for my job and the people that I work with. So I'm very, very, very fortunate to be here.
Lucky.
Yep.
All right, I'm going to ask you my last question, and that is, do you have any other advice for writers regarding the publishing process as a whole, or just writing, or anything that occurs to you?
I would say a lot of people want to be writers, but what they don't realize is that to be a really great writer, you also have to be a really great reader.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people who write novels should read 2,000 novels before they even pick up a pen. They should read 2,000 novels. They should keep detailed notes on what works and what doesn't, what they like, what they don't. And that's the metaphor of sharpening the knife.
Mm-hmm.
A person who wants to be a writer has to know what good writing is, and the only way to know what good writing is to read it. And sometimes the only way to know it is to see really bad writing. So you have to read a lot. Lee Child, who in my opinion is a very good writer, reads all the time. Joe Finder, who is also a very good writer, said that he read, I think, 2,000 novels before he started his. Stephen King says the first million words are practice. You can write while you're reading, but at the end of reading 2,000 novels, you'll have a much better idea of what works, how people develop character, how they create tension. You absolutely have to read enough. I think if everybody read 2,000 novels before they picked up a query pen, I'd see a lot less unpolished material, which I think would be a good thing. And if they want to start, they can start with all my client books. I'll be happy to send them all a list.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. This was really fun.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about my job, which I love, and talk to people who love books.
Isn't she great? She was so much fun to talk to. That was Janet Reed with Fine Print Literary Management in New York. Next week, tune in to hear an interview with Gary Kowalski, the author of 7 books and senior minister to the First Unitarian Universalist Society in Burlington. We will discuss his recent book, Revolutionary Spirits, The Enlightened Faith of America's Founding Fathers, which is due for release in paperback this June. Today's Write the Book prompt is to write a query letter. It should be a single page long. And according to Janet Reed, it should be as well written and carefully thought out as you can make it. Avoid hyperbole and cliche. Avoid the expression, my book is about. Your book has to be finished before you write the query letter and ask for representation, especially if it's a novel. If you query by snail mail, always include an SASE, and that stands for self-addressed stamped envelope. Always include your email address and phone number on the query letter, and address the letter to a specific agent, not to a long list of names in an email, and do not address it to agent, as in dear agent. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast, as will a link to Janet Reed's excellent chart about what you need before you query, which can be found on her wonderful website, jetreed.blogspot.com. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. Upcoming episodes of the show are often announced in my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.